Morning.
No.
All right. I'd like to call this May 12th, 2023 meeting of the Arizona State Board of Optometry to order at 8:02. Agenda item B, roll call.
Dr. Stephanie Mestoris. Dr. Stephanie Mestoris. Okay, noted absent. Dr. Stephen Cohen.
Present.
Dr. Christopher Carpenter.
Present.
Dr. Robert C. Brown. Dr. Robert Brown. Okay, noted absent. Diva Galan. Diva Galan. Okay, noted absent. Sammy Hamed.
You pronounced my name correctly. Present.
Mona Baskin.
Good morning, present.
Board staff, Margaret Whelan.
Present.
And Fawn Becker, present.
Dr. Kelly Moffitt.
Present.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to go back. Okay.
I believe we have a quorum, Madam President.
Yes.
Thank you, Fawn. Excellent job.
You're welcome.
Agenda item C, board purpose statement. The board meeting statement of purpose, a license to practice optometry in this state is a privilege granted by the Arizona legislature through the Optometric Practice Act. In 1907, on behalf of the people of the state, the legislature created the Arizona State Board of Optometry to regulate the practice of the profession of optometry, issue licensure where appropriate, and in general, assure the public that the practice of optometry will be conducted with reasonable skill and safety by persons who meet the curriculum requirements to hold a Doctor of Optometry degree from an accredited optometry school. To enforce the Optometric Practice Act, the board reviews applications for licensure and complaints relative to the conduct of its licensed optometrist and is charged with determining if the provisions of the Optometric Practice Act are met. In addition, the board may promulgate rules and policies in conformity with the stated purpose of the board and the mission as mandated by law. As of January 1, 2019, all board meetings are digitally recorded with the recordings of the audio available to the public on the board's website under the consumer information link. Agenda item D, declaration of conflicts of interest, if any, for this meeting. Are there any conflicts anticipated with our upcoming agenda? I'll state for the record that I know one of the respondents, Dr. Brent Hartzell, although I feel I can be even-handed without bias in our judgment.
Fair and impartial.
Fair and impartial. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. India, any other conflicts to declare? Okay, I hear none. Agenda item E, President's report. I have no report today. Agenda item F, review, discussion, and possible action of investigative reviews and complaints. As this is a virtual and telephonic meeting, I'd like to request all participants to preface their comments with their name first. When referring to a patient, please use their initials only. And I'd just like to make sure I know who is present before we begin. So I think patient DG.
Is yes. Present.
Okay. And patient BZ.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. And I see attorney. I did. Megan Gailey. Is that correct?
Morning, Madam President. Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Thank you. And then let me see. Dr. Kopp, I see, is present. Dr. Hartzell, I see, is present. Dr. Shao, I see, is present. So we'll start then with agenda item F1, Dr. Stephen Kopp. Would one of the board members like to offer a board summary, please?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'd be happy to offer a summary.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter.
Patient DG sought an eye exam with Dr. Kopp, and glasses were prescribed. He went to get it filled at Costco, and they alerted him that there was no prism in this prescription and that he had used prism in the past. So the patient contacted the clinic and said, hey, there's no prism in here. I normally have prism. The then Dr. Cobb said, let's have him come back in. We'll do a refraction check. So they did that. And he determined the type and the amount of prism that was needed, and it was prescribed. The patient then received the lenses that were made with the prism and felt like they looked noticeably different than what he was used to. And sure enough, the prism was in a dish orientation. I believe it was made as base out instead of the usual base in. And but he decided to try the glasses, but experienced discomfort and then reported some difficulty in hearing back from the doctor and getting the correct prescription. Ultimately, Dr. Kopp instructed his staff to go ahead and refund the refraction cost so that he could go seek a refraction elsewhere.
Dr. Carpenter, patient DG, this is your opportunity if you'd like to address the board and explain from your perspective what happened.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to, giving me the time to speak and also for doing this hearing. In my 66 years, I have never had a situation where I received not only one incorrect prescription, but two from the same physician. Even getting one is shocking, but getting two is beyond the pale. In my case, fortunately, other than wasting my time, there was really no damage done. I had actually looked at other suppliers for lenses, and had I done that, I might have been out hundreds and hundreds of dollars. But fortunately, in the end, glasses are so expensive, I just went back to Costco. Since they had filled my prescriptions in the past, they immediately knew that there was an issue with the prescription. What I would really like to bring to the board's attention is not so much the mistakes that Dr. Kopp made, but how they happened, which I think is more important than this particular singular issue. Barrett Delaney Perkins, with whom he works, is what I kind of call a medical mill. Anybody who's been to Sun City will notice that all of the surrounding streets of Sun City, there are these beautiful edifices of medical offices like you have never seen before to service the obviously lucrative Sun City medical market. It's not just optometry, it's cardiology, it's every ailment known to man. There is a beautiful office either on Bell Road or Thunderbird where you can go to have that taken care of. Barrett Delaney is one of those. They have an incredible facility. I think it's on Neek or on Dell Web, wherever it is. I've never been in an optometry facility that was as large, opulent, or as filled with patients as that particular location. On the day that this occurred, or the days that this occurred, there were several dozen patients waiting to be served in the lobby. The way they operate is very much like a factory. You walk in, you're told who your physician's going to be or your optometrist. You go from one station to another where a technician takes various tests. They put eye drops in your eyes. And it's like, go to station one, we're going to do this. Go to station two, we're going to do this. Finally, you end up in an examining room where another technician is sitting there who then takes your, in my case, took my glasses from me, looked at them through some type of device, which is, by the way, when I would assume she would have noticed that I had prisms. Any layman who's ever seen a pair of glasses would know that I had something, because these glasses are as thick as Coke bottles. And it's because, obviously, of the prism. The doctor came in. He spent 10 minutes with me, maybe. It was all very perfunctory. It was very quick. It was very efficient. And I just felt like I was a bystander to my own examination. He left. This technician filled out the prescription, gave it to me. And that process occurred both times that I was there. The issue that I really would like to bring to the board's attention, regardless of this particular incident, is the question of whether or not patients are best served in an environment like this. I don't know whether, you know, how busy Dr. Koff is, how many appointments he has during the day, but I certainly felt like I got the bum's rush. And I have a feeling that that's just the way it is. And I'm standing up as a patient to say that this is not right. Many of the patients who go to this practice are not there for glasses. They're there for surgery, for cataract surgery and other surgeries. And I have to wonder, has anybody been hurt by this? I was not, fortunately, other than aggravated. But this is a surgical center. And if this is the way they treat surgery patients, then I find that frightening. And I urge the board or whoever the applicable authorities are to look into this, not just this particular practice, but all this stuff going on in Sun City, because it's frightening. And so I'm not here to comment on Doc. I'm sure Dr. Koff is a highly qualified and, for all I know, very caring physician. I'm not here to impugn his character or to impugn his professionalism or anything else, but I will say he works in an environment where this kind of mistake could happen. So what I'm saying to the board is don't only just look at this particular incident, but raise the question about whether or not this particular clinic and others like it are delivering healthcare the way they should. And, I actually asked the attorney general to look into this, and they're not going to do it because they're not going to do it. So that's all I have to say. I'm not looking for blood. I'm not looking for Dr. Koff to get in a lot of trouble, but I did want to have this hearing to raise this issue and ask you, as the board that's supposed to regulate the quality of eye care in the state of Arizona, to seriously consider what I'm saying. And that's all I have to say. And I appreciate your time. And I'm not going to stay. I'm going to leave and let you guys talk with Dr. Koff. I'm uncomfortable in this situation, but I do appreciate the opportunity to have been able to raise this issue. And I certainly hope that something comes of it.
Thank you, Patient DG. Ms. Gailey and Dr. Koff, this is your opportunity if you would like to respond.
Good morning, Madam President, Madam members of the board. My name is Megan Gailey. I am legal counsel to Dr. Koff. As was set forth by Dr. Carpenter, I think that is an accurate summary of the complaint allegations in this particular case. We responded and provided a thorough response regarding what happened with this particular patient's care and treatment when he presented. When he presented on January 11th, 2023, the technician did do a refraction, and it was also verified and checked by Dr. Koff with no significant differences between the two of them. When the office was contacted regarding the patient's complaints that he did not have a prescription regarding the prism, the office offered to have him come back to have the refraction redone. At first, the patient was hesitant to come back in, but eventually he did. The refraction was redone by Dr. Koff. When Dr. Koff did it, he got inconsistent readings with respect to the prism. He provided a prescription, the patient left, and it was later brought to the attention that the prescription was incorrect. In response to this, Dr. Koff refunded the patient's costs associated with the refraction and also referred him for a second opinion to have that checked again. As the patient indicated in his statements, he was not harmed by the actions regarding the incorrect prescription being given to him during the course of this. There has been no violation of the Practice Act, and we ask that this case be dismissed on behalf of Dr. Koff. Dr. Koff is here. We weren't sure if the board had any questions regarding his interactions and care and treatment of this particular patient, and he is happy to answer any questions the board may have if it comes up during the deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gailey. I'd like to remind everyone to please put your microphones on mute just so we don't pick up background noise when one party is speaking. Dr. Kopp, would you like to address the board? If so, this is your opportunity. When we have our own discussion, if we have questions for you, we can ask you them at that time. But if you'd like to speak, this is your chance.
Good morning, Madam President and board members. I really don't have anything further to add. You know, there was a mistake made in the PRISM, and that's very unfortunate. We try to be as accurate as we could be. And I don't know if it was maybe some something lost as far as a scribe error or some sort of transpositional error, but an error was made. That's all I have to say for now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Kopp. This will conclude open discussion, and I'm going to open this discussion up now to the board for their discussion. Are there any board comments?
Let's is Dr. Carpenter.
Great, thank you, Dr. Carpenter.
So just a question I had, I couldn't quite tell if Dr. Kopp was ever made aware of the amount of prism that were in the glasses. I know he had access to the habitual lenses to measure the prism, but just wondering if that was ever considered what the patient was already wearing in making the decision as to what to prescribe.
Yes, I was not made aware that I can recall the amount of prism that was previously prescribed, so I can't recall.
Okay.
Any other comments, Dr. Carpenter? Okay. I'll make a few comments and things that stuck out at me just while reviewing this, and we'll move forward with the rest of the board. So this comment is for the patient's benefit, just so that you're aware. I looked at your prescription, and particularly in the right eye, you have a high minus prescription, which will create the larger the frame, the thicker the edge on the glasses. And so when looking at a pair of glasses, if it has a thick edge, that doesn't always indicate prism is present. It can also indicate a high minus prescription. A minus lens will have a thick edge the further it gets away from the optical center. And so minus lenses also have kind of a thicker edge. And then a couple of things to know about prism. And this is something that I tell my patients, actually. I tell them to always, if they can, bring me their old prescription. If I haven't seen them before and they have an old prescription with prism in it, to bring it in, so that I know exactly how much is in the glasses. Most practices nowadays have what's called an auto lensometer. And when you go to measure the glasses, the auto lensometer sort of helps to find the optical center for you of the lens and then does kind of a quick automated reading. And it may indicate prism, but it is always incorrect. No doctor uses that to indicate the presence or absence of prism. Glasses are made of prism. And when they add prism to glasses, they are simply decentering the prism. Prism, as light goes through a prism, shifts light towards the apex of the prism. And so when they add prism to glasses, they move that in front of the eye to move the image for the eye. So the best way to check for the presence or absence of prism and the amount of prism is with a manual lensometer, which most of the time we have in the optical, but the doctor's offices frequently don't have anymore. I don't have one except for in the optical. And even when I have my optician read it, I never go from her readings, even though she should be the most reliable measure of prism, as she measures every prism prescription and every prescription that comes in through the optical. I still view that as an unreliable measure. So I always tell my patients the best way to have this is to always indicate to the doctor that you have prism in your glasses. And if you have your old prescription, if you're happy with the prism balance, then we can simply match it. But if you don't know, then I measure from scratch and I start from there. But there can always be deviations in the amount that I get that someone else may have gotten. Because as you wear the glasses and use the glasses, your eyes vary compared to someone else's, how much reading maybe you do compared to distance work, compared to computer work. And so the level of fatigue may vary. And so the amount of prism oftentimes has to be tweaked. And so if you have a pair that you're happy with and your balance is good, most of the time we just want to match it. I will say that I looked in the record to see if Dr. Kopp identified the deviation correctly. In his response, he did put in there that he there must have been a transcription error, that he put the wrong direction of prism in, or the technician, I don't know if he has a scribe in the room, if that's how it happened. But it looks like he did identify and was aware, at least, of the deviation from normal. And it does make sense then that it was a transcription error, that it wasn't just a doctor, a lack of understanding, a lack of ability, I guess, is what I'm getting at. So I thought those were important things for your information to pass on. I'll also say, with regard to our purview as far as the board goes, we license individual doctors of optometry in the state, and we monitor them and their ability, I guess, to perform in their duties. And so we don't get to evaluate the business of Barnett Delaney. We don't have purview over that. We have purview over Dr. Kopp. And so those are my comments for you. I'd like to ask also Dr. Cohen if he'd like to offer some comments.
No, I think that you covered it quite well. And I have no further comments because I see no violation of statute.
Thank you. Mr. Hamed, would you like to offer comments?
Madam President, I have no comments.
Okay, thank you. Would someone like to offer a motion in this case?
Yes, hi, this is Dr. Cohen. I'd like to make a motion that in the absence of any apparent violation of Arizona optometric statutes, that the complaint filed against Dr. Kopp be dismissed.
Is there a second?
I'll second. This is Sammy Hamed.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Okay, so we've had a motion and a second to dismiss this complaint. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Thank you. Dr. Carpenter, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. I'm gonna call complaint F2, Dr. Shane Sanders. Actually, I'm going to revise. Let me first start with Dr. Hartzell, since he is present and counsel is also present. And patient is present. Okay, so would someone like to offer a board summary here for Dr. Hartzell? Dr. Cohen, would you offer a summary, please?
I have two computers. I have trouble pulling it up, and I have the one that was scheduled, if I might be able to provide the summary on that case, if you don't mind, versus this one, because I'm having trouble pulling it up.
Yep, no problem. I'll offer summary in this case. So this is Bren Hartzell, IR number 202313. Patient BZ called Dr. Hartzell's office on September 8th, 2021, complaining of a near point reading problem and also a central vision blur, persistent for times 2 weeks. Patient was seen the next day with Dr. Hartzell. Patient's perception is that she wasn't dilated and was advised on reading glasses at the 9/9/21 visit. She subsequently saw Dr. Alma Murphy, who diagnosed an epiretinal membrane in this, I believe it was the right eye, and sent the patient to retina for follow-up evaluation. She was dilated at this visit, it's in the record, and the epiretinal membrane was diagnosed at the visit. We have imaging and it's in the assessment of the exam. I will also say, which is relevant at least to us clinicians, that she had been in June 21, best corrected visual acuity in that eye was 20/40. At the subsequent visit, 9/9, vision, best corrected visual acuity was also 20/40. So that'll do for my board summary. I'd like to open this up for patient comments. Patient BZ, if you would like to address the board, this is your opportunity.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me. I have an extensive history of eye problems. I have had cataract surgery in my left eye, They weren't able to put a contact lens in because I had iritis and they didn't, it was dormant at the time. They did not want to disturb it. So I have very limited vision in my left eye. My right eye is the good eye. I have had bone decompressions. I have soft tissue decompressions and I have had inferior rectus muscle surgery in the left eye. So I was not able to have binocular vision. So when I opened up my, when I woke up on the morning of my vision problem, I couldn't read my cell phone. And I usually look at my cell phone because my mother is elderly and she emails me messages. My sister emails me messages. I couldn't read the cell phone. It was very blurry. I thought that was kind of strange. So I went in to try to read a newspaper and I could not read a newspaper clearly. So I got on my computer, which was hard to read. I got the phone number for Dr. Hartzell's office. I called, made an appointment, got in. And I feel like the exam was okay, but he used a binocular indirect ophthalmoscope, which should have he should have seen the macular pucker at that time. If he would have dilated me and put me on the slit lamp, he would have definitely seen the pucker. So I have had difficulty driving since that time. 1 week prior to seeing Dr. Hartzell, I was in the care of an ENT. And he told me I was having dizzy issues. So I went to see him. In the span of seeing him for 2 months, I told him, I said, my vision is still blurry. I cannot see out of my right eye very clearly. And so he did the BPVV test, which is benign posterior or benign, whatever it's called, for vertigo. And he said, well, you don't have vertigo. His audiologist said I had vertigo. So my next visit with him, I said, I still can't see very well. And he said, well, I think you have macular degeneration. You need to go see your optometrist or ophthalmologist. I said, well, I thought to myself, I've already seen the optometrist. I'll go to an ophthalmologist. And so I made an appointment to see her. And because I was still having dizzy issues, my PCP sent me to have an MRI and MRA, which didn't come up with anything like a brain tumor. But I thought, well, I'm still not seeing. So when I went to see Dr. Alma Murphy, she saw that I had a retina pucker and sent me to the retinal specialist. And I have been seeing them since February of 22. And I have had probably 7 injections and probably another one next week. But I think that the binocular indirect ophthalmoscope should have indicated that I had a pecker and or he should have put me on the slit lamp. So I think that there is a problem there and it should have been detected. And yes, I still have good vision. I can still do 20/40, but it's too blurry. And when I'm driving, I can't see street signs and I have a very hard time seeing a turn signal. And that is, that's dangerous. And so the only time I drive is where places that I know I'm going to go to that are short driving locations, or I have someone take me. And I cannot drive at night now because last year when I had my driver's license renewed, I did not make all of the letters. I missed 2. So I said, they told me I can't drive at night now because of this vision problem. She told me, she said, well, do you have another pair of glasses? I said, yes. And she says, well, you may want to get those glasses and come back in and do another exam to see if we can change your license. And I said, it's not the glasses. And so that's where we're at right now, because I still have a vision problem. And I think that there was a missed diagnosis.
Thank you, BZ. Ms. Gailey, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Madam President. As you know, I'm legal counsel for Dr. Hartzell in this particular case. As you correctly stated in your summary of this case, Madam President, this is a case where she did undergo a dilated exam and an OCT was performed, which showed the macular pucker. If you look at Dr. Hartzell's notes from September 9th, it clearly indicates that he went through his diagnoses, went through and provided education to the patient. At that time, he did not believe that that was the source of her vision complaints based on comparison to when she was seen 3 months prior. Her OD vision had remained the same. And based upon that, he recommended follow-up and for her to return. In looking at it, there was no violation of the Practice Act by Dr. Hartzell in this particular case, and we ask that this case be dismissed. Dr. Hartzell is here and he is available to answer any questions that the board may have regarding his care and treatment of this particular patient.
Dr. Hartzell, would you like to take an opportunity to address the board?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Madam President and board, for being willing to discuss this situation, which, first of all, I do feel bad that BZ feels like the care was not to the level that she had expected. In reviewing the case, I went through and compared what I had seen and what I had counseled on. Originally, she had alleged that we had not dilated on that day, and her vision had not changed, but yet still, we actually did perform a dilated fundus examination. And she says also that I didn't perform slit lamp examination, which I actually performed slit lamp examination on every single patient, whether they're dilated or not. But I not only performed slit lamp examination, but also a binocular indirect ophthalmoscopy. I did note that there was a macular pucker on my examination, and we performed an OCT of the maculae at that time, which I saw traction not only in the right eye, but also the left. But at that time, there was no intraretinal fluid. And because there was no fluid, she already had cataract in that right eye. And I, you know, in my relation with the retinal group in the past, they have always counseled that they don't even consider treatment for macular pucker, especially in the presence of cataract, unless the vision's 20/50 or worse. So her vision being 20/40 did not rise to the level that I felt like she needed to be seen by a specialist, in large part because I didn't want her to have to go through that whole process to find out that they weren't going to need to do anything. I did also recommend that she follow up with me again, and she didn't end up coming back for a follow-up. But with that being said, I feel like, you know, what we needed to do, what we needed to address were all addressed at that time. So I do feel bad that she feels like it was not addressed, but that was has always been my goal, is to make sure my patients are taken care of and understand the nature of their conditions and the care that we can provide for those.
Thank you, Dr. Hartzell. So this will conclude open discussion, and I'll open this up for board discussion now.
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. First and foremost, it's very easy to feel a tremendous amount of empathy for patient BZ, quite an extensive description and obviously quite impactful on your quality of life. So don't want that to go unstated. Also, I'd like to state that in reviewing the records and the description, Dr. Hartzell seemed to not only meet the standards of care, but I think did an exemplary job, as he just did with explaining it. As far as the differentiate, even though Dr. Hartzell just commented about having done BIO as well as slit lamp, when it comes to looking at a macular pucker, it's not that a slit lamp is going to do a better job and catch something that wasn't seen with the BIO. The key is to find it. The OCT does show that. And probably the critical issue here, as I see it, is that between the cataracts and the best visual acuity at the prior visit, there appeared to be no change. So it wasn't necessarily a patient that, because it was progressing, needed perhaps to be seen by a retinal specialist at that time for possible treatment of the macular pucker. So I feel as though the situation is very unfortunate and the impact it's had on patient BZ. I fail to see where there's been a violation of any of the statutes by Dr. Hartzell.
Dr. Cohen, Dr. Carpenter, would you like to offer comments?
Yes, this is Dr. Carpenter. I agree with what Dr. Cohen had said and what had been stated. Yeah, it is extra scary when you just have one good eye and vision starts to slip, and that is frustrating. But as was stated, as I reviewed everything on that visit in September, everything was done appropriately, and it was diagnosed as a macular pucker, and there wasn't enough change or decline in vision to trigger a referral at that time. We don't really have any more as far as exactly what was said or how much importance was placed on that diagnosis of macular pucker, or if patient BZ left that appointment feeling like she would have wanted a referral, or like there were still, maybe in her mind it wasn't resolved, but just based on the documentation we have, it does look like the care met the standard and no violations were performed.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Mr. Hamed, any comments?
Yes, Madam President, I'll make a comment quickly here. Regarding patient BZ, I understand your situation. I see where you're coming from. I'm a person myself with one eye. And so I understand how that goes, and you need procedures done like a cataract surgery, which I had done back in 2021. I'm sorry that it wasn't to your level of satisfaction at that time, but I do believe that an error wasn't done and that it could have been communicated better at the time. Pardon the metaphor, hindsight is always 2020. It's been communicated better as well. But I completely understand it. So you're going here, but I will have to say that I don't see there's a violation. I'm going to have to agree with my board colleagues on that one there. But my apologies all around for this situation. That it's unfortunate, but it had to come to us. But that's what we're there for here, if you will, for us to call balls and strikes, if you will. And we hopefully gave you that chance to us in some form, if not seek the redress you want, but do at least at the minimum be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Hamed. I'll also offer some comments for patient BZ. I think it's been expressed, and I also share in my colleague's sentiment that this is unfortunate. When you have one good eye, it's very alarming when there anything starts to go wrong. With regard to an epiretinal membrane, just a couple of comments. It's clear in the record that it was identified at that visit. It's clear in the record that you were dilated. The scan that was done of the macula shows a mild, what we would call a mild epiretinal membrane. We can see the layers through the macula. We can see the membrane. We can see the layers underneath. If you are getting injected at retina, that's for something that has developed after this, actually. So injections, just so that maybe you understand this and we all understand this issue. Injections aren't offered for an epiretinal membrane. So there must be some subsequent swelling that developed as a result or some other issue that you're being injected for. Had I seen you as a patient, I will say that I think Dr. Hartzell's care was excellent also. Everything was done that should have been done. A lot of doctors might've even missed this at presentation because your visual acuity hadn't declined since you were dilated 3 months prior. So it's really unlikely that something had developed. And yet in this case, you were dilated and it was identified. It's clear in the record. It was identified. There was no other issue that needed treatment. I also would not have referred based on this presentation to a retina specialist. Most of the time, they're only going to intervene and do a membrane peel, which is surgical intervention on this, if the vision is maybe 20/60, 20/80. Because a lot of the time when they do a peel, the visual recovery is going to be around a 20/40 level. So if there's no gain to be had, there's no treatment to be had. I wouldn't have referred this either. So I'm very sorry for this sequence of events, but I don't see any error in how Dr. Hartzell handled it. Would anyone like to offer a motion in this case?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I move that we dismiss the case on the grounds that there's been no violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I will second Dr. Carpenter's motion.
Okay. So we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Hartzell. Is there any further discussion? Okay, So we'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Thank you. Dr. Carpenter, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Thank you, everybody. Moving on to complaint F2, Dr. Shane Sanders. Is patient RM present? Okay. And is Dr. Sanders present?
Dr. Sanders is not present, Madam President.
You're representing him though, Ms. Gailey?
I am. I'm here on behalf as lead counsel for Dr. Sanders.
Thank you. Would the board like to offer a summary for Dr. Sanders?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen, Madam President. I'll be happy this time to step up and offer a summary. Patient RM was seen in 2021 and 2022 Dr. Sanders at M&M and questioned repeatedly about the fact that this was a medical exam and the patient did not want a medical exam, had not asked for a medical exam, had been told for 20 years that there were cataracts present, but apparently had not been progressive. And that even to the point that one of the doctors apparently said there's a good chance would never need cataract surgery. Patient saw this as a regular eye exam and was questioning the why billed for a medical exam that was not asked for, and stated that tried to contact the office a couple of times and did not get any answer. In response, the doctors at Dr. Sanders' office stated that they didn't have any record of whether or not the patient had tried to reach them. But more importantly, in the course of reviewing the exam, the cataracts were noted, slight decrease in best corrected vision in both eyes, primarily the left eye, and at various times had seen mottling of the macular area in addition to the cataracts, and a larger cup to disc ratio, as well as I believe there was a PVD in there, partial PVD in both eyes. So there were medical issues that were found and issues that typically would be included in a comprehensive subsequent eye exam.
Madam President, you're muted.
Thank you, sorry. Ms. Gailey, would you like to respond on Dr. Sanders' behalf?
I would, Madam President, members of the board. I think that our response to the patient's complaint clearly set forth what occurred in this particular case. I think based upon this particular patient's ocular history, it did warrant the same examination in 2022 that the patient received in 2021. In fact, in 2021, the patient had basically declined to have his eyes dilated, and that was in fact done in 2022. I think in looking at this patient's history and course over the course of time that Dr. Sanders had been treating him, it showed that it was the same examination time from 2021 to 2022. It doesn't appear that there was a violation of the Practice Act, and we ask that this case be dismissed. Thank you, Madam President.
Thank you, Ms. Gailey. I'd like to open this up for board discussion then. Comments from the board?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'd like to make a comment and maybe a question. I agree that it is not, there's been no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. It looks like the patient RM received excellent care. And I know patients sometimes get frustrated or confused because of billing and vision plans versus medical plans, or maybe he just wanted a refraction only, but we're obligated obviously to make sure the eye health is good. I did notice as I scrolled through the history, at least in previous years, he had VSP, which is a vision plan, as well as Medicare. And this wasn't specified, but I just wonder if in years past, VSP was billed and then he just had his VSP copay, but maybe at some point, the practice decided, hey, if we bill this through Medicare instead, because there's medical things, you know, we can get a better reimbursement. And I don't know if that's what's happening, but sometimes, and I don't think that's even in our purview, but I know that that can be frustrating for patients. Anyways, I'm just wondering if that was a component as to what happened here.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Cohen, any comments?
Yeah, the only thing I'd like to add to the summary is that perhaps from the patient's perspective, because of the dilation done in 2022, perceived this visit to be different than prior exams. But I look at it and clearly feel as if with the history, with the findings of prior exams, including this one, that a refraction by itself would not be sufficient care given to this patient. It does require it to be a medical exam, regardless of how that winds up being billed.
Thank you. So I actually had some concerns with what I saw in the record. So this is a gentleman in his, so I'll start first by saying, yes, there's a distinction between vision and medical insurance, and it's oftentimes confusing, and it's hard to distinguish for the patient the difference. I will frequently say to my patients, honestly, when you come in and you refuse to be dilated, it's like going to your primary care doctor and saying, you're not allowed to check my cholesterol, you're not allowed to check my blood pressure, you're not allowed to check these basic fundamental elements of care. And most of the time your primary would tell you then not to return unless you are ready to have a medical exam. So that is frequently my approach to an issue like this. This is a gentleman, like I said, in his upper 70s and low 80s, was seen between 2016 and 2022, and at most visits was not dilated. He clearly has medical issues in the record and still was not dilated. When he was dilated, which I could really best tell from Ms. Galey's response, it was with 0.5% tropicamide, which we all know does not actually stabilize the iris and does not give you a good peripheral retinal exam. And so I find the care that Dr. Sanders has offered this patient lacking. In the care, you notice, I'll call on Dr. Cohen's observation, cataracts are even graded in this evaluation, but without a full dilated eye exam, we can't grade a cataract very well. You see about a sixth of the cataracts through the center of the pupil, and you miss the back edge of the pupil, you miss the periphery, or excuse me, back edge of the cataract, the periphery of the cataract, you can't evaluate a cataract well. So I thought it was interesting that it was graded the way that it was. And in the record, you have an incidence where the intraocular pressure was elevated and above normal. It was failed to be mentioned in any kind of assessment. There was no follow-up regarding that. Dr. Cohen, you brought up, enlarged CD. I find this irresponsible and reckless care, frankly. Over a course of 6 years that this elderly gentleman is not being dilated on an annual basis, you can't find pathology if you don't look for it. And you can't look for it if your patient isn't fully dilated or dilated at all, which is mostly what occurred. So I, in my opinion, believe that Dr. Sanders should have a letter of concern written to him, as well as a suggestion for 5 CE hours in posterior segment disease. And my suggestion, or I'll make a motion in a moment too and see if I have agreement. But this shows to me, it shows a pattern of failing to meet the vision examination standards in accordance with the standards of care in the community and consistent with the industry practice. And that's R4-21-304. This is because there was no dilation, failure to diagnose ocular hypertension, or follow-up regarding that. And the CE suggestion comes from ARS 32-1744-D4. So those are my comments, and I'll open that up to the board to see if I have any agreement among the board members.
Yes, Dr. Moffitt, this is Dr. Cohen. Thank you for adding that. I think that our focus here was first and foremost on the whether or not this is a medical exam and looking at that. The one area and why I specifically mentioned the cup to disc ratio is because of a concern that that was not addressed in there. I would at least do additional testing to see if that were just a habitual issue for this patient or if it was a cause for concern of perhaps early glaucoma or glaucoma at all, especially in light of the fact the pressure had been elevated a little bit. So in light of the points that you raised, I would tend to agree that there are some question marks here, but initially addressing the issue whether a medical exam was warranted or not. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Dr. Carpenter, any comments?
No, not really. Nothing to add to that.
Mr. Hamed?
I vote aye.
I haven't stated the motion yet, but I appreciate that.
I misheard. I'm sorry about that, Madam President, but I have no comment, if you will.
Okay. So I would like to make a motion that we send a letter of concern to Dr. Sanders regarding a pattern of failing to meet the vision examination standards as previously stated in accordance with R4-21-304 for a history of non-dilating or non-dilation with this patient and inadequate dilation when commented on. I think that that is something that should be mentioned. A failure to diagnose ocular hypertension and a CE requirement for 5 hours in posterior segment disease. Is there a second?
This is Dr. Cohen, I will second that.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
Yes, this is Mona Baskin, Assistant Attorney General. Dr. Moffitt, Dr. Cohen, members of the board. If you would take a look at ARS 321744 regarding the board options, certainly you could issue both a letter of concern, but they are listed separately and they're slightly different requirements regarding issuing the non-disciplinary CE and the LOC. So, if you would like further information and discussion, we could go into executive session. Generally, it's Ms. Whalen, do you have any comments?
Well, I'm not sure I understand exactly, Ms. Baskin, the concern. Can I not send a letter of concern and stipulate in a non-disciplinary order with 5 hours of CE?
You may be able to accomplish what you're trying to do with the letter of concern through the non-disciplinary CE. And if you'd like to go into executive session for further discussion, I am certainly available for that. Because the non-disciplinary order of CE will provide that notice to the licensee.
They are duplicates. So let's just do the non-disciplinary order, 5 hours of CE.
That's up to the board, Madam President.
So Madam President, are you, this is Sammy Honda. Madam President, are you gonna withdraw your motion and remake a new one then?
Maybe, once I figure it out a little bit.
This is Dr. Cohen. May I ask Ms. Baskin a question? Is what Dr. Moffitt's saying now sufficient, or do you still feel that there's information we need to understand that would warrant executive session before we go any further?
I believe that Dr. Moffitt is clear. However, you always have the option to go into executive session for further questions with legal counsel, and I'm certainly available for that right now.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so I'd like to amend my motion and suggest that we assign a non-disciplinary order 5 hours of CE in posterior segment disease to Dr. Sanders because his records show a pattern of failing to meet vision examination standards in accordance with the standards of care in the community and standard industry practice.
And Madam President, those hours will be in addition to the 32 hours required for renewal.
Thank you.
And also, Madam President, was there a time frame for those extra hours?
I think 6 months would be great.
Okay. Thank
you. What I would propose. Is there a second?
Yes. Hi, this is Dr. Cohen. I will amend my second per Dr. Moffitt's modification.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, so we have a motion and a second to assign a non-disciplinary order of 5 additional hours of CE in posterior segment disease to Dr. Sanders. Let's vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter.
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Let's see here. Okay, and then we'll jump ahead to agenda item F5, Serena Shao, IR number 202315. Would someone like to offer a board summary?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I'd be happy to provide a summary. Patient WB was filing a complaint based upon the fact of that the eye center refused to give a prescription unless there was a fee paid, and that the Medicare did not cover the refraction upon paying. Then the $52 was then granted the prescription. In response to this, one quick thing I want to check here. Dr. Pongrantz had...
We're Dr. Shao.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I in the wrong one? I'm sorry, I'm two committees.
I did skip around a little bit there.
Then I apologize. May I come back and do that one later?
Sure.
I apologize.
Dr. Carpenter, would you like to offer a summary for Dr. Shao?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So... the complaint that was raised by WC against Dr. Shao, so he presented on March 31st of this year for a routine eye exam, and he had been seen exactly a year prior to that, also for a routine eye exam. When he showed up, he was informed that Medicare did not cover all of his charges from 2022. Because the deductible had not yet been met. And so they went ahead and charged him for that, along with the refraction and whatever incidentals were due for his 2023 eye exam, which he paid. He paid $194.72. And then he did some investigating and found that his paperwork from Medicare said that he should not be charged any more than $118 for that 2022 visit. So then he added the $39 for the refraction that he owed for 2023. And that adds up to $157 approximately. And so he's wondering, why did he pay $194? But he also was questioning just the office's ability to recoup that money from a year ago. Why was he never billed? So on and so forth. According to the practice, their side of it was he was billed for it, but there was never a check sent in. And so it's standard to just kind of carry that balance to the next year. I did a little bit of digging and went through some of the charges, and it does look he was charged correctly. There was $106.72 carried over from last year, 2022, from Medicare. And then you add the $39 refraction fee for this year. And then it looks like the office charged him another $49 under wellness. I'm wondering if that's just a wellness screening, like an OCT wellness screening or something. But if you add those up, you get the $194.72. So anyhow, that's the summary.
Thank you. And there were fundus photos. I looked up what those were. That's the code for fundus photos, that wellness exam.
That 49, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so I don't believe the patient is present. Patient WC, are you present? Okay. I hear no response. So Dr. Shao, if you'd like to address the board, this is your opportunity.
Hi, hello everyone. Thank you. I think Dr. Copperton addressed the whole summary very clearly and thoroughly. And I also presented the EOB from Medicare from 2022 Dutch visit, and everything was billed correctly. And we did send the paper bill to the patient sometimes around July 2022, but we never heard anything back from him. So of course the balance carry over till this year's eye exam 2023. And before we started any eye exam, we did make it really clear that, yeah, there's an outstanding balance. We would like to collect the outstanding balance for us to complete the previous charges, and then we can continue for this year. And then there was no objection. Patient understood everything, like no complaints, no argument, and then we proceed with everything. So that was it.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Shao. So I'll open this up then for board discussion, comments from the board.
Yes, Dr. Moffitt, this is Dr. Cohen. It's interesting that the patient commented that what would have happened if he did not return a year later, he then wouldn't have been confronted with this outstanding balance. But according to Dr. Shao, an attempt was made to be able to build this amount. And I think it's fairly common, we all experience the perception that insurance is an agreement between the doctor and the insurance company, when it's really an agreement between the patient and the insurance company of which we facilitate. And if we are a provider on a plan, accept what assignment for what it is their usual and customary to reimburse would be. But it does not wind up negating the obligation of the patient to pay any co-insurance or unmet deductible. And the patient even commented that he is often not sure what his deductible is or whether it's been met, and often relies upon the doctor's office to do that. So I fail to see where this is not an unpaid balance that is owed to Dr. Shao's office for services that were rendered, even though it was a year later.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. I agree. I have a question for Dr. Shao since we have her on the meeting. I have a concern that this is a 72-year-old male, history of pseudophakia and retinal detachment in the right eye, and you saw him 2 years subsequently and didn't dilate him at other visits.
He refused to be dilated that time because I did mention that, hey, you had a retina surgery past history. I highly recommend to dilate, and then but he refused. So that's why we always have patient to sign the consent, the refusal, everything.
So I didn't really see a consent signed refusal. And I'll also state for my own position that usually if you have a conversation, and this is a retired physician, this patient, but usually you have a conversation with the patient that, you know, this is really a standard of care issue. I won't see you if you won't consent to be dilated. This is really what I say. You have a risk here. You have a previous retinal detachment, an elevated risk of ocular disease. This is a standard of care. I won't see you if you don't allow me to work at this, you know, at the appropriate level. So I usually will document that in the record that I have discussed the importance of dilation with the patient and he refused. And I mean, I will say something, I will handwrite it in there that I have discussed this with the patient. I didn't see anything like that in your records.
Yeah, sorry. I guess we did not provide you with the consent because I was only asked to provide with the charts and the ledger.
Yeah, and we asked for all records regarding the patient, and this is what we were provided. And so then I have to judge based on what's in the record, what I think. But I find this inadequate, frankly. And I think it's irresponsible if you're not dilating a patient with a history of retinal detachment, the other eye is at risk, the eye with the retinal detachment and repair is at risk. And so I'm just stating my feelings on that for the record. I agree that the billing is appropriate and that the patient should have been billed. I'll move this forward to Dr. Carpenter. If you'd like to make comments, Dr. Carpenter.
I have nothing more to add other than what has been said.
Thank you, Mr. Hamed. Any comments?
Madam President, I have no comment on this.
Thank you, Mr. Hamed. So I'm going to make a motion again in this case that, or in this complaint, excuse me, that the record shows a pattern of failing to meet the vision examination standards in accordance with standard of care in the community and consistent with industry practice. This is according to R4-21-304. And I would recommend a non-disciplinary order for 5 hours of CE and posterior segment disease in addition to the standard 32 hours due at relicensure for Dr. Shao. Is there a second?
May I make a comment? This is Dr. Carpenter.
Sure.
That's under the basis that the patient was not dilated.
At either visit. So to me, it shows a pattern.
And the doctor's position is that that they refused. And I think she said that the patient did sign a waiver for that, saying that they refused. I feel like maybe before we take such an action, that she should, if the patient really was given that option and they refused and signed something, maybe we should wait to see that before we, if that paperwork exists or whatnot. This might be a little extreme, I think, in this case.
Madam President?
Go ahead, Mr. Ahmed.
Yes, this is Sammy. I agree with my colleague who just brought that point right now. I think we should hold off and wait to see if there's any paperwork. But one thing I would like to see being possibly done is that it hasn't been done. I think a refund should be issued in this case as well, actually. It's a little bit of an extreme, it's a bit of a rare step, but I think in this case it would probably merit it. As part of any action that we order for Dr. Chu.
So, Mr. Hamed, we're not allowed to order anything like that, like a refund. And it is appropriate, actually, if the patient carried a Medicare balance from a previous visit, that he was charged that at the subsequent visit, he had to pay his portion of the bill. So I don't think there's grounds for that, and we can't. Can't order that.
Yeah. But regarding what was just that, I think we should hold off on voting on this and get that extra documentation.
I would, for my part, I would suggest that Dr. Shao should have provided that with the records as requested initially from the board. So that's my position. Dr. Cohen, how do you feel?
Yeah, I have a point of order question, sort of after the fact. We've entered into this discussion. Is the appropriate approach supposed to be that if you make a motion, there should be a second and then discussion, or are we okay having this discussion without there having been a second of your motion? Just a point of order.
Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Cohen, it's fine either way. You know, this is just the early discussion phase. And so if the board doesn't feel like they're going to second it, this would be a good time to have the discussion rather than have the motion and second.
Thank you, Ms. Whalen. My comment would be, though, I agree with you, Dr. Moffitt, about the fact that records, including state's records, should be sent. I feel in this case was, I don't get the sense it was withheld with any malicious intent, and feel as if it would be reasonable if Dr. Shao could produce that document. We may still arrive at the same conclusion based upon standard of care, but at least to be able to substantiate that it was discussed with the patient.
Okay. I'll state again, just my opinion for the record, that it's a waste of the board's time if we request records initially and records are not sent, and then we have to wait and review records again and do this at a future date. I find that to be the responsibility of Dr. Shao. That's my position.
Madam President?
Yes.
This is Sammy Hamed. Point of order, your motion does not have a second, so technically it could be dead unless someone here wants to make a second to your motion. And if that's the case, then I'll call for the question as well, if a second is made to that motion.
I agree. There's been no second, and we're discussing it right now. So I think we have to all find common ground on how we want to move forward.
This is Dr. Carpenter. Since we are having a discussion, could I ask one other question? If we do get a second on a motion, do we have to be unanimous for it to pass when we vote, or is it just a majority carries it?
Majority carries it.
Okay. Thank you.
And then if the motion doesn't pass, we move back into discussion.
Correct. If there's no second to the motion, then the motion dies for lack of a second. or if it is seconded and then we could have the vote, and if it fails, then there would need to be another motion of some kind.
So a doctor, another member of the board right now could, while we're waiting for a second, we could go ahead and amend and propose a different motion and see if there's a second, then a vote.
No.
Dr. Moffitt should call for a second. Yeah. If there is no second to her motion, then it dies, and then you could submit another motion.
Dr. I did call for a second.
Okay. So then hearing none.
Okay. Well, this is Dr. Cohn. For the sake of at least addressing the issue, I will offer a second to the motion in looking at it overall, based on the fact that the opportunity for Dr. Hsiao to produce the document that stated is there, even though I recognize it takes up additional board time, may have been an oversight. And on the flip side, I see no harm in Dr. Hsiao being able to receive additional training. So I don't have a strong feeling both ways about it, because I don't see any harm either way, whether it's taking up a little extra time or providing Dr. Hsiao with a opportunity to get an additional level of education. But I do second the motion.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Is there further discussion? Okay, so we'll vote. We have a motion and a second to assigned 5 hours of additional posterior segment disease continuing education in addition to Dr. Hsiao's 32 hours required with licensure for failing to meet vision examination standards in accordance with standard of care in the community and consistent with current industry practice. So we'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote? Mr. Hamed, you're muted. There you go.
I vote no.
Okay. Dr. Carpenter, how do you vote?
I vote no.
Dr. Cohen?
I vote nay.
I vote aye. So motion fails. Would someone like to offer an additional motion?
Yes, hi, this is Dr. Cohen. In deference to, I think, a legitimate issue that you bring up, Dr. Moffitt, I would make a motion that Dr. Hsiao be permitted the opportunity within a limited time frame to produce those documents, and that failure to do so would wind up then requiring action of 5 additional CE hours within the next 6 months in posterior segment disease.
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. Dr. Cohen, it's actually not an appropriate motion. The board already voted to issue the non-disciplinary action for 5 CE hours, and it was not passed. So the only option would be at this time, if you do want the records as the board, would be to direct staff. You would table it at this time and direct staff to collect the records if they're available, and it will go on the next board meeting to finish this discussion, at which time, after reviewing the records, you would have a new motion and discussion.
Madam President?
Go ahead, Mr. Hamed.
I'm going to make a motion that we table this matter to the next meeting and direct staff to collect the records as appropriate, as was just noted by Ms. Whalen.
Is there a second?
Point of order, do I need to withdraw my motion first if I put too much into it?
Yes, you should. This is Mona Baskin. Yes, Dr. Cohen, please withdraw.
Thank you, Ms. Baskin. I will withdraw my motion at this time so we can consider the alternative.
Is there a second?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'll second it.
Okay, so we've had a motion to table this complaint. And staff have asked staff to further work with Dr. Hsiao to obtain appropriate records and to revisit this at a future meeting. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Sorry. Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
I hate to be a stickler on it, but I want to be clarify that in light of doing that, what we're saying is there a time frame in which we are requesting that information come? Because you got a motion, a second, but there's no discussion about the motion.
How long do we give for records request?
20 days.
Okay. Mr. Thank Hammond, you. Do you want to amend your motion?
Okay. I'll amend the motion appropriately.
Ms. Baskin?
Yes. Yes, Ms. Whalen. This is Mona Baskin.
I'm sensing that you're unhappy with the direction of the...
No. I think that it was, if they want to provide that additional clarity, that is fine. But that is a process of the board that is normally included in subpoena language. And I believe the board directed that they be presented at the next board meeting. So that would have been sufficient. But that clarity, if you want that additional clarity, that is within the board's discretion.
Ms. Bessel's right. I did say by the next board meeting. She is correct in my motion.
Okay, so shall we go back to voting?
Yes, sorry to have mucked the waters there, but yes, under those, this is Dr. Cohen, I vote aye.
Okay, I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. All right, moving on, agenda item F4, Melissa Pond Grants, IR number 202314. Is patient WB present? And is Dr. Pond Grants present? So I'd like to open this up to board summary. Dr. Cohen, I believe you called this one.
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen, do I dare? Hopefully I'll get it right this time. So this is very, very simple in terms of summary. The patient WB was seen and is a Medicare patient, and the refractive portion was not covered and was told that the patient could not get a prescription unless paying the refractive charge of $52. And that the response was from Dr. Pongrantz that is a requirement that would be furnished the standard protocol and that would be furnished the prescription upon payment of the charge for the part that Medicare does not cover as part of their exam.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. I'll open this up for board discussion then. Comments from the board?
This is Dr. Carpenter. Yes, we see this a lot, just the confusion between what Medicare covers and what they do not. But I don't see a violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Cohen, comments?
Yeah, and yes, this is Dr. Cohen. Dr. Moffitt, you've done a good job of being able to remind us that our responsibility is not just to respond to the actual issue, but if we notice anything else that may be called into question, we have an obligation to do so. I do want to point out that in this case, with a history of cataracts and the patient being diabetic, that there is notation of dilation, not only with a 1% tropicamide, but also with a phenylephrine kicker in it. So at least want to note that that was accomplished in this case.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I'd like to see appropriate care. All right, my comments with regard to this complaint against Dr. Pongrantz, I agree this is a non-covered service by Medicare. It's patient's responsibility for the refraction if they want the refraction done, and I don't see any violation of the Optometric Practice Act. Mr. Hamed, any comments?
No comments.
Thank you. Would someone like to make a motion?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I move that we dismiss this complaint on the grounds it does not violate the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you. I'll second that. Further discussion? So we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Pongrantz. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter.
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Moving on, agenda item G, review, discussion, and possible action on pending examination applications for licensure pursuant to ARS 32-1722 and R4-21201. Number one, Dr. Amit Bombri. DPS report was negative for any criminal history, but the patient disclosed a previous charge and submitted a lengthy, and I would also suggest a humble explanation of the occurrence. Are there any concerns or comments from the board member board members regarding approving Dr. Bombry's licensure application? Any concerns, Dr. Cohen?
This is Dr. Cohen. No, Dr. Moffat, I agree with you. I thought that the explanation was quite lengthy and did demonstrate a humility and that the patient did voluntarily bring this issue up. So I do not feel any concern.
Thank you. Dr. Carpenter?
I agree. Thank you.
Mr. Hamed?
I agree as well.
I do also. Would someone like to make a motion? I would move to approve Dr. Bambury's application for licensure. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, we'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Agenda item H, Executive Director approval of new license applications pursuant to ARS-32-3123. Number 1A through I, are all new license applications approved? Agenda item I, review, discussion, and possible action of approval of a testing center for proctoring of jurisprudence exam pursuant to AAC R4-21-203C. Great Plains Technology Center in Lawton and Frederick, Oklahoma. Any concerns or comments from the board members regarding approving Great Plains Technology Center as a testing center for the jurisprudence exam? Dr. Cohen, any comments or concerns?
No concern, but I always like to state the fact that that Ms. Whalen and her staff have done their due diligence in reviewing this prior to us taking this action.
Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Cohen, yes, we absolutely have. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, no, but actually, Ms. Whalen, mine was not a question, it was a statement because I know you did, and I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that you have done your due diligence before coming to us with this issue.
Apologies, thank you.
Dr. Carpenter, any concerns?
No concerns.
Mr. Hamed? You're on mute, Mr. Hamed. Any concerns?
I'm sorry, I have no concerns. No, sorry about that. My connection kind of went bad for a second.
Gotcha. Thank you. Would someone like to make a motion?
Madam President?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I move that we approve the testing location as outlined on the agenda, the Great Plains Technology Center in Oklahoma.
I'll second it.
Thank you. So we've had a motion and a second to approve Great Plains Technology Center in Lawton and Frederick, Oklahoma, as a testing center for proctoring of the jurisprudence exam. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Agenda item J, review, discussion, and possible action regarding opening a rulemaking docket, amendments pursuant to ARS 41-1039610. Number one, telehealth application and promulgate a new rule to establish the fee. Ms. Whalen?
Thank you, Dr. Moffitt, members of the board. This is my request for the board to start having discussions about rules. We just had our five-year rules review, which I submitted in April. That's required for the agency to review its rules, at least on a five-year basis, to make sure that they're still working and that they're clear and concise and that there are still statutes that gives authority to that rule. So I haven't received any feedback yet from the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, but in the interim, we do have our continuation bill. We have some statutory changes that are coming to the general statutes that will affect our rules and things like that. And also pursuant to the sunset review for the audit, As you know, there was a couple of rules that they felt needed clarification. One was the CPR certification that comes to mind, and there was a couple others. So I would just like permission to begin the process for me to start looking at the rules and making changes, which I will bring to the board for discussion and to open a docket.
I think this is an excellent idea. And I think that some of the rules definitely need some revision as they apply to sort of current practice compared to when they were written. So I'm all for it.
Well, and Madam President, if I may, members of the board, I encourage you to look at the rules in your leisure. Just kidding. I do encourage you to look at the rules. And if there's anything that stands out to you or, you know, changes that you might like to see, we can definitely, you know, take a look at that. That would be very helpful to me.
So maybe we should have a due date by that for that, that the board members look through the rules and any concerns they have with the way the rules are written, they should turn in their comments to you by a certain day. What does everybody think about that?
This is Dr. Carpenter. This might be a silly question, but which rules are we including and where do we find these rules?
It is our, Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Carpenter. It's in our Arizona Administrative Code. So it's all the ones that start with R4-21 dash something, something, something. Those are our rules. So it'd be any of them, the definitions, the licensing rules, anything that's in that rules section. No, I was just going to continue. You should have the statutes and rules book that I gave you when you first came to the board. If not, I will send it back out to everybody just in case. And the rules are at the very end. So the statutes are listed first and then the rules are at the end of the booklet.
Dr. Carpenter, it starts over at the end. It says Title IV professions and occupations, and then all the rules are stated after that. And the page numbers will start over at page one. So it's like the last maybe 6-7 pages of our statutes handout.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Baskin, did you have a comment?
Yes, I did. Just for the record, I had a little bit of technology issues where I couldn't hear everything that Ms. Whalen said. So I just want to verify that for the record that Ms. Whalen has advised the board that pursuant to ARS 41-1039, she has contacted the governor's office and has obtained approval for the board to move forward with rulemaking in this area. And then I would also, as a second, caution the board members that when providing feedback, it goes directly to Ms. Whalen and that there's no reply all. I know that she blind copies everybody, but just as a caveat that there cannot be communication with other board members on this. And that I'm anticipating that it will be brought to the next meeting for further discussion. Am I correct, Ms. Whalen?
Yeah, do we need to have it done that quickly? Can we do two meetings maybe?
There was a short turnaround. Madam President, members of the board, I'll jump ahead, I guess, to the future board meetings. I was looking at June 2nd would be our next meeting, but also July 7th is the next meeting after that as a date. So if you think about that while we're going through our agenda here.
I'll state for the record, June 2nd is my birthday and I would prefer July 7th.
Fair enough.
I don't know if that matters, but I'm still putting it out there.
Madam President, members of the board, I think July 7th is plenty of time to at least just get it rolling. And, you know, this is a little bit of a process, as you know, as some of you know, if you've been around at all. The rules can take 10 to 12 months. It's not a quick process, but we just need to have the ability to, you know, open the docket to get it going. We have to have oral proceedings and things like that. So we just want to make sure we have the best rules possible, you know, and keep the language tight, keep it concise is the goal, so.
I agree. When do you think would be a good time for us as board members to have reviewed the rules and submitted any comments or suggestions that we think maybe should be considered for changes?
Honestly, Madam President, members of the board, I think even August would be fine because that will give me time to open the docket and just get that prepared. The docket can be open and sit there, so that's not a big deal. So that way, you know, because summer's coming, there's vacation time. I'm actually out for almost 10 days for the ARBO annual conference, which is in June. And so I think August at least would be fine, or even September if you wanted to really just give it some time.
All right. Well, so then maybe at our hopefully July 7th meeting, we can review with more board members present the, you know, concern with reviewing all the rules and putting all of our suggestions in front of you.
Perfect.
This is Dr. Cohen. First and foremost, I would like to see us wait until July in honor of Dr. Moffitt. I think we should spend June 2nd, whether with her or not, celebrating her birthday. But as a question, if we do it in July, August, I'll be out of town, but I will be available for a meeting, so my time will be more flexible. Do you anticipate, Ms. Whalen, if we do this in July, that it might require more than the typical 2 hours we block out? So that maybe I should block out additional time, or do you think the review could be done in the normal confines of what a meeting usually is?
Thank you, Dr. Cohen, Madam President, members of the board. I think the 2 hour time frame is just fine. You know, we're not going to be amending all the rules. That would be highly irregular. Our rules are in fairly decent shape. There's just quite a few I feel that are, needing to be fixed, but I'm thinking maybe like 4 or 5 rules that are like urgent. And the rest of them, you know, we just need to look at them.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments, Dr. Carpenter?
Just listening to Margaret just now, it just made me think, you may have already touched on some of these rules, but could you maybe send out an email to us, maybe specifying the trouble areas just so that we can look at those, and then as well as, you know, just kind of screen over everything, but so we kind of have some direction.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. I certainly can. I think that would be very helpful to you all. So yes, I can definitely do that.
Great. Mr. Hamed, any comments?
Yes. I think July 7th is a good time, I think. And it's like what Ms. Whalen said, it's going to take a while, 10, 12 months. There'll be a bunch of back and forth between the ninth floor and Ms. Whalen about the rules. That's just the way the process goes, if you will. And I think that's a good time to get an update then, and another update sometime in the fall, if not August, maybe September, October, actually. And regarding the board renewal, obviously that's political gamesmanship, which has been covered by the media and things. And I'm confident that the legislature will approve a renewal for the board before they sign any die. Since they got the heavy lifting of the budget out of the way, the rest will be easy, in my opinion, from here on out.
Thank you. I think that's coming up, actually, in the agenda today. A little bit of that. Okay, so does that conclude our discussion? Or were there any other issues you wanted to address, Margaret, with regard to the rulemaking docket?
Madam President, members of the board, I think that covers it. I appreciate your consideration and approval to move forward.
Absolutely. We don't need to have a motion?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Agenda item K, review, discussion, and possible action regarding sunset review, agency continuation. Number one, SB 1075 Optometry Board continuation, now HB 2862. Ms. Whalen?
Thank you, Madam President. As Mr. Hamed alluded to, the continuations for not only our board, but Access, Dental, and Naturopathy were being held. We aren't really sure why. It possibly is leverage. As you said, it's the political game. So it's always a little bit scary, though, because you just don't know. And our continuation was actually moved under the budget bill, which is House Bill 2862. And it had a do-pass recommendation earlier this week on the 10th. So that would have been Wednesday. It went to committee of the whole in the House, so hopefully it will just keep on moving through. And the bill does provide for a retroactive effective date, because technically our agency sunsets on June 30th, well, actually on July 1st of this year, if the continuation is not passed. So when the bill goes through, of course, 90 days sine die is usually September. We would have to retro that back to July 1st, otherwise the agency would cease to exist for those 2 months. So at least that's written in there. So I am expecting that it will continue down its happy little long path there. I'm disappointed that the regular continuation didn't go through as submitted, and also the 8-year maximum that's available now, it was 10 years. We're one of the last agencies that's under the previous 10 years. We only got 6. They're only giving out 6 at the legislature. So I'm not sure why, but that's really unfortunate for auditing purposes, because as you can see, it's a lot of work to be audited, but we are appreciative of what we get. So the continuation would be for 6 years, and it would continue the agency to 2029. At this point.
Okay. And then agenda item K2, SB 1227, State Board of Optometry, proposed statutory changes and cleanup.
Yes, thank you. So disappointingly, that bill was quashed by ophthalmology. As you may or may not know, as board members, ophthalmology has strong representation and opposition to optometry. I'm seriously disappointed, professionally speaking, because there wasn't any scope expansion in this bill. It was strictly language cleanup. Ophthalmology came forward and said, we don't like your new definition of surgery. We changed it back. We tried to compromise as much as we could and reverted back a whole bunch of language that they didn't like. And they still kind of had the ear of the legislators more than I did. So they do have professional lobbyists for ophthalmology. Unfortunately, it's just me. As some of you may recall, Governor Ducey removed our ability as agencies to hire outside lobbyists. And so even though it's my job to be a lobbyist, I'm not a lobbyist by trade. And I also don't have time to be camped out at the legislature, which is really what's required of that process. The Arizona Optometric Association graciously had Don Isaacson, who is their lobbyist, helping us whenever they could to just kind of keep their ear to the ground and make some calls on behalf of the board for this bill. But in the end, we have a freshman legislator who was the sponsor, and I think his nerves got to him when it came to ophthalmology. And also, I think it has to do with the PAC. You know, ophthalmology donates more money than optometry does. Unfortunately, that's the political game. So, you know, we weren't as strong as we probably needed to be as a profession to support this bill. So I plan to try again next year for next session, and hopefully we can actually enhance the bill with the Arizona Optometric Association and do some scope expansion as well. So it would be language cleanup and scope expansion. So not giving up, just the bill is dead so far for this year, unless Don has a miracle up his sleeve. Sometimes, you know, we can have it as a striker in another committee or something like that. That's super sneaky, but I highly doubt that. So again, super disappointed because I really wanted the language cleanup that we had. We all worked so hard on that. So,
Ms. Whalen, may I ask a strategic question of you just on this issue? Having served as the legislative chair for a period of time and also past president of the AZUA, I know about, you know, the experience, all of the political gamesmanship have nothing to do with the merits of what's being proposed. But Do you feel as if next year strategically you combine potential expansion of scope of practice with this cleanup would then give them opportunity to knock both of them down under the guise that it's an expansion rather than as a separate issue, a cleanup and expansion another time or in another bill?
It definitely would, Dr. Cohen, and we probably would do two bills so that we could get one without the other, so to speak. But sometimes, you know, it's hard to say. I think that it varies, to be honest with you, in the legislature, because you know, historically, when we have run our sunset legislation, that is when an agency would include any language cleanup or statutory changes. And this year, and maybe over the last couple of years, the continuations have been requested by legislative council to be separate from any other activity. So that way the continuation could go through, and the other bill wouldn't hold up, the other portion wouldn't hold it up. So it depends on what year it is, I think. You know, sometimes they want, and then they want them together, because I got told, well, you should have put it in your sunset. And I'm like, well, I want the sunset. I want the continuation to go through. I don't want to hold it up. So you do run that risk. So yes, I think we could do two bills.
Margaret, if we're not allowed to hire a lobbyist, do you see any other options available to us to try and move this or any future, you know, proposed legislation, move it forward in a better way? Do you think there's anything we can do as a board to advance our position?
Well, I think that, you know, as board members, you can certainly contact the sponsor of the bill, you know, on behalf of the board. If once the board has discussed and agreed, you know, like we did this last time and the bill has been created, because that's all lobbying is just, you know, making phone calls and sending emails and asking for support. And I think that's where, you know, the board members would come in, you know, contacting the sponsor and telling them how important the bill is. You know, from a professional's perspective, it's appropriate for board members to meet with legislators at any time, any board member. So I think that would be very helpful.
Is that still appropriate now, or did we sort of, it is?
No, that's appropriate because we're lobbying. That's, I mean, we have a right to lobby. We just don't have a right to hire someone to help us out. And as you can imagine, you know, like I said, while I very, very much appreciate the AZOA offering up Don's services, you know, it's a conflict of interest for him, only because it's not their bill. So, I mean, he was fighting for the board to an extent, you know, with caution, because he would say, well, you know, my client is the association, but we support the board, and we're, you know, he really did help us out quite a bit. So I think it just has to do with people, you know, hitting up their legislators. I mean, even if you're a constituent, you know, find somebody who's a friend of the legislator, who the sponsor is, you know, maybe we want a different sponsor next time, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, I think we might need direction from you on this, but if you communicated with us, who we should contact, I mean, I'd be happy to try and contact. And I mean, even if we just sent emails from the board members, you know, maybe that would be helpful, or try to talk with them at legislatures separately. But I'm sure the board members, it would not be a big investment of time. And if it would make a difference, maybe that would help. We all spent time reviewing the language changes, and I think we want to see it pass if we can. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely can help out with that process. I apologize for not doing that this time around. I didn't realize the board members were interested. I mean, I didn't ask for it because I, you know, felt like it was moving, actually. And then of course when ophthalmology's lobbyist came in, she just kind of tore the whole thing up. But for some reason she has their ear. She's been around a while, and like I said, unfortunately, you know, it's kind of known that ophthalmology donates a lot more money to political activity campaigns than optometry does. So I think the biggest thing that optometry needs to fight for when it comes to legislation is the fact that optometrists are highly qualified, highly educated, you know, individuals within the profession, because ophthalmology always makes it sound like optometrists have some random certification that they purchased online, you know, that optometrists are definitely not qualified to do what they're doing. So, you know, that kind of gets the antennas up of the legislators, because they're like, oh, well, we don't want people doing, you know, crazy things. But of course, that's not the case at all. So.
Okay. Well, I think it'd be great if you had contact information of people you thought that we should reach out to, at least to try and promote, you know, the passage of this or the movement of it even. I'd be happy to participate.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And I will send it out to you. I mean, it's never too late. Session's not over. You know, the bill hasn't moved, but at least, you know, put the bug in the ear for next year. Because I'm sure Senator Shope is probably not going to move it forward, but I'll definitely pass that along.
Okay. Madam President, this is Sammy, if I could comment.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd be willing to help as well on that, and hopefully we can get it through. And like Margaret even said, it ain't over until they say the word sine die, you know? So they could pop up out of nowhere, basically. I'm glad to hear that Mr. Eisenstein, who's a respected lobbyist, was helping with that. And hopefully he'll be back at it again next year. Margaret, I got a question for you. Who was the sponsor of the bill?
Senator T.J. Shope, S-H-O-P-E.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, he's from Coolidge. I know who he is. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't count him out, actually. Being the Senate President Pro Tem, he might have a rabbit or a trick up his sleeve.
He is, yeah. And he's co-chairs with Mr. Montenegro for the Health Committee, Stephen Montenegro. He's my district, actually. I'm his constituent. So I've reached out as his constituent. So, yeah, so we'll see. Like I said, not over yet, but we
I'm willing to help out as well.
Pardon?
And I'd be willing to help out as well. Just say the word.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I'll send contact information for the senator and representative and to their staff. And, you know, like I said, even if nothing happens this year, at least just reach out and put your name out there and, you know, identify yourself and that'll get it rolling. I think that'll be very helpful. I mean, the board does need a stronger showing. That's the problem. We never have been. And typically boards are not, you know, we're just not built that way. So that's why a lot of boards would hire outside lobbyists. So big boards like dental board and medical board are really, really suffering, and nursing, terrible, terrible. Because they really do need an outside lobbyist.
Should we move forward now to agenda item L, executive director's report?
Yes, please. All right. Item number one, the budget. So again, our fiscal 23 appropriation is $298,800. As of April 30th, our beginning cash balance was $575,591 with an ending cash balance of $573,585. 83.33% of the fiscal year has elapsed. And that's not the right board spending. I'm sorry, I don't have the board spending. I forgot to change that figure. It says 51.15, but I'm sure we're closer to 70 some percent. Again, our fiscal year ends June 30th, so we will be starting fiscal year 24 on July 1st. Staff activity from April 1st to May 11th, we had 64 renewal applications that were processed. 27 new applications were received. Of those, 14 new licenses were issued. Around 47 phone calls were returned that were left as voicemail, and 2,196 emails were received and answered. To date, we've had 5 board meetings, including this one, and that is calendar year board meetings. Thentia update, item number 3. So our build out for Thentia, the e-licensing, is moving along. We've had a couple snags with project managers at Thentia being out sick for long periods of time. So that's put us behind a little bit because they don't have the staff to cover, but they have been making strides with other staff to sort of fill in during that. We're going over the mapping process right now, which means we're telling them what we want in our program. The requirements, everything is going to be built out with any luck pursuant to statute and rule. I have very clearly given them the parameters. I've copied and pasted so that it's verbatim when it comes to the application, the questions, the requirements, the deficiencies, all that kind of stuff. Our expected launch was actually this month. It should have happened already. They were looking at the end of April, early May, but because of the delays with staffing issues on Thentia's end, we are looking at a launch at the middle or end of June. And I do kind of have a June 30th drop dead date because after that, Salesforce is no longer supported, number one, and number two, to keep the system going for our e-licensing, we would have to pay for 2 new licenses for Salesforce, which would be about $12,000. So we definitely don't want to double pay, basically. So we'd have to pay for Salesforce and we're paying for Thentia. I've been assured by the powers that be at Thentia that we will meet that date. So I've sort of threatened everything if we don't because we don't want to pay for Salesforce. So I'm very excited. I think the system's going to be great. Ms. Becker and I will be training probably starting next week, either late next week or the week after. It's called UAT, that's the training area where we can do testing and things like that. So we'll be testing out the applications for front end and back end. So once that kicks off, those of you that have not renewed yet this year, will see the new interface for Thentia. Any questions about the e-licensing before I move forward? Okay. Item 4, legislative session, the bill review. Let me just start by saying, again, this year is the 56th legislature first regular session, which began Monday, January 9th, 2023. Yesterday was day 123 of session. To date, 1,562 bills have been introduced, 826 in the House and 736 in the Senate. Of those, 195 bills have been transmitted to the governor, 101 from the House, 94 from the Senate. 129 of the 195 were signed by the governor, 77 House bills and 52 Senate bills. There were 66 bills that were vetoed by the governor, 24 House bills and 42 Senate bills. I'm just going to report on the bills that are on my list here that were transmitted and signed by the governor. The rest of them are still either moving or aren't moving, but they weren't in a substantial place where I was going to report on it. So let me just go through this list real quick. House Bill 2255, funeral practices, transportation protection agreements, that was transmitted to the governor and signed on April 28th. It was Chapter 95. House Bill 2517, government documents, sex identification. House Bill 2473. I need to make my screen bigger. There we go. House Bill 2473, dental hygienist scope of practice was increased, transmitted to the governor on April 6th and signed on April 11th. That's Chapter 36. House Bill 2525, barbering and cosmetology, unlicensed employees. That's where they allow the unlicensed employees to practice under the license of another licensed person. That was actually signed by the governor on April 5th and is under Chapter 22.
Ms. Whalen? Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. I'm really having trouble hearing for some reason. I don't know if anybody else is, but could you please identify the bills by the ABCD? I'm kind of having trouble keeping track and hearing.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Let me go to my Senate bills here. Senate Bill 1087, that one hasn't moved. 1078, item W, Senate Bill 1078, podiatric medical assistance. That was signed by the governor actually on March 28th as part of Chapter 5. That one actually required that the radiation, the x-rays that are taken in the office, that they didn't have to be radiologists. So they had an exemption because prior to that, they were taking x-rays, just kind of how they do at the dentist's office. And apparently that became an issue for somebody. Senate Bill 1176, item Z, health professionals address confidentiality. That was signed by the governor on April 12th. That's under Chapter 37. That states, of course, that a health practitioner may have a confidential address. I don't know that became a problem. Our board's always had that where you get one public, one confidential. But this bill says that, you know, the agency can't send out your confidential address, which we never would anyways. So redundancy department of redundancy, as they say. Senate Bill 1226, item EE, dental board, business entities and records. Transmitted to the governor on May 8th and signed, I'm sorry, transmitted May 3rd, signed on May 8th. Senate Bill 1218, Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board, that was transmitted to the governor on March 23rd and signed on the 28th. Gail had some scope expansion, so her scope expansion was approved, and she's actually part of the continuation bill that I talked about earlier, that 2628. Let's see. Senate Bill 1248, item FF, scope of practice, process and repeal. That was vetoed by the governor. It was sent on February 27th and vetoed on March 3rd. Senate Bill 1255, letter HH. Was transmitted to the governor on May 3rd and was vetoed on 5-8. That one had to do with rulemaking, costs associated with rulemaking that the board would need to ratify and propose costs, which we already have an economic impact statement where we have to tell the economic impact to any small business or resident or practitioner, but this was some weird like regulatory cost recovery. I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I didn't pay too much attention because it wasn't really going anywhere. So I'm surprised it even got to her desk. Let's see, Senate Bill 1270, which is item II on our agenda, was transmitted to the governor on April 3rd and signed on April 6th. It basically says you have to have enough seating at your public meeting for all people that attend. I don't know why we needed a legislative directive on that, but there you go. Senate Bill 1382, item MM on our bill, that was pharmacy, transmitted to the governor on April 12th, signed by the governor on April 18th. That was requiring certification for their benefits managers for pharmacists, for companies. And Senate Bill, bear with me. Go up to my house bills now. I'm not reporting on all these, like I said, so. House Bill 2255. Oh, I took it off there. That's funeral services. That one was signed, though. It's transportation protection agreements that has to do with transporting the body to the cemetery. House Bill. Sorry, I'm just looking through my list here to make sure I got everything. Okay, I mean, that's it. So the rest of the items on this list, you know, haven't been moving or haven't been signed by the governor. They're still in a holding pattern. So again, it is late in session. And since the budget's been signed, they're probably going to end session very soon. It usually ends the middle end of May. They don't like to go into June. So I guess we'll see what happens in the next few weeks. But all the other bills on here are just sitting there waiting for approval. Item five under my agenda item, are there any future agenda items that the board would like to see at the moment?
Just the rulemaking information that was.
Yes, I'll send that out, but here, rulemaking. And then, item six is future board meeting dates. Again, I had June 2nd and July 7th, but it looks like maybe July 7th is a good day for our next board meeting.
I vote for July 7th.
Anybody else? Thoughts and availability?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I believe I can do July 7th.
Okay, and Dr. Cohen, you said you were out, but you might have a phone.
No, this is Dr. Cohen. Again, I think June 2nd, we should be all celebrating Dr. Moffitt. July 7th, I would be available, and I will be available August, September, depending on the dates, because although I may be away, I'll have access to be able to sign on.
Okay. Mr. Hamed, are you amenable to July 7th?
I am fine with July 7th. We should do June 2nd as well. I mean, if anything, we have the board vice president could run the meeting. Maybe it might be a little shorter, what have you, whatnot, but I'm fine with July 7th as well as June 2nd and onward.
Okay, I appreciate your comments. Thank you. And of course, I will ask Drs. Braun and Mastoris and Ms. Galan. I'll send an email out and make sure. So let me ask the question then, Dr. Moffitt, are you okay if you don't attend the meeting if the board wants a June 2nd meeting for Dr. Mastoris to run the meeting, or how do you want to handle it?
So I would say that we should have a meeting if we have appropriate business to attend to. I don't think we should just set up a meeting just to set up a meeting. So, correct. Yeah. I'm fine with Dr. Mastoris running it, but poor Dr. Mastoris, I don't know if she's fine with running it.
So. Yeah, I will check. So right now I have one complaint that came in, and we'll have maybe a few applicants. So, I mean, if that's the case, you know, we always could have a special meeting and not June 2nd. We could do a quick lunchtime meeting to get those applicants approved, you know, if need be. Otherwise, July 7th really isn't that far away. It'll be here before we know it. And our board is only mandated to meet 6 times per year. So I appreciate the effort by the board, but I mean, theoretically, we could meet every other month and meet that requirement. So
well, that's minimal, but we did that. We have longer agendas and longer times.
Yeah, exactly.
We're already running up to the time limit as it is.
Yes. Okay. So I have July 7th as our next meeting. So I'll send out that email just as a placeholder so everyone can set up the meeting, and then I'll know if everyone's available. Okay.
Do we still want the 8 a.m. times? We're still everybody happy with 8 a.m.?
Mm-hmm.
Fine with me.
Yes. Yes, Dr. Cohen, that's fine with me as well.
All right. Okay. Well, that concludes my executive director's report, Madam President and members of the board.
Okay. Thank you. Agenda item M, call to the public. Are there any members of the public that would like to address the board? Okay. I hear nothing. Agenda item N, motion to adjourn. Would anyone like to make a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Yeah, this is Dr. Cohen. I'll second that. It wouldn't be interesting if we didn't get a second on this one either.
All right, any further discussion? All right, we've had a motion to adjourn and a second. Let's vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Point of order though, first real quickly. I don't think under the Roberts rules you need a roll call. I think it's just the motion to second and be adjourned. But for the sake of the record on this, I'll vote aye.
Ms. Baskin?
Yes, this is Mona Baskin. The problem is that the board does not keep any written minutes. So all we have is the audio tape. So it's always best, you know, it's just best practice to roll call. You could also do a voice vote on, you know, a motion to adjourn if the board wanted to. It's just been the procedure. So.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Carpenter? Yeah.
Aye. Let's adjourn.
Dr. Cohen?
Reluctantly, aye.
I also vote aye, very reluctantly. All right. All right. Have a good day, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, everybody.